Iran's foreign minister says the expansion of economic cooperation with neighboring regional and Asian countries is a top priority of the country's economic diplomacy. Israeli forces kill a 16-year-old Palestinian girl by shooting her in the head during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Also ahead, one person is killed and five others are injured in clashes between security forces and protesters demonstrating against Peru's new government. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the Iranian foreign minister says a central plank of Tehran's economic diplomacy is to further enhance economic cooperation with neighboring countries as well as other regional and Asian states. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment at a ceremony marking the 30th anniversary of the expansion of the Economic Cooperation Organization. He said Iran attaches special significance to the ECO and takes every opportunity to boost cooperation among member states. The top diplomat added Tehran pays due regard to further strengthening the role and status of multilateral organizations such as the ECO, which speed up mutual cooperation and contribute to regional economic development. The Economic Cooperation Organization is a political and economic intergovernmental bloc that was founded in 1985 by Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey. After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the ECO expanded further with the inclusion of Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan in 1992. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians know no bounds. The regime's forces have killed one more Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, a 16-year-old girl was shot dead during an Israeli raid in the eastern neighborhood of the city of Jenin. The raid also left three injuries. Jenin has been a focal point of Israeli violence against Palestinians. In recent months, the regime has also intensified its crackdown on Palestinians across the occupied territories. So far this year, the Israeli military attacks have taken the lives of around 220 Palestinians in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Islamabad says heavy gunfire and artillery shelling by Afghan forces has left at least six civilians dead across the border in Pakistan. The Pakistani army said it retaliated at a border crossing in the southwestern Balochistan province. Afghan officials say the incident was accidental and the situation has now returned to normal. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Nasser Kazmi, joined us earlier to tell us more about the attack.
This was the attack which has targeted the civilian in Pakistan. Especially, this is the porous border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the reports confirmed that six people have lost their lives, while 17 other was wounded in this attack. And there was an emergency declared in all the hospitals in southwestern Balochistan province, while the rescue teams took the wounded persons to the hospitals, where many of them are said to be in critical condition. This attack was carried out by Afghan border forces, and the Pakistan military says that the Afghan forces used heavy machine guns and artillery, and they fired mortar shells on the civilians in Pakistan. This was the second attack in the last 10 days. We have witnessed that a Pakistani high commission, the Pakistani head of mission in Kabul came under attack in Pakistani embassy, and Pakistan lodged a protest in front of Afghan government and asked the Taliban that to stop such attacks and to provide the security to the officials who are working in the embassy, as well as the civilians who are living inside Afghanistan.
Meanwhile, the United Nations mission in Afghanistan is urging the Taliban government to put an end to violations of human rights under their rule. The mission issued the call in a statement marking Human Rights Day. It said all restrictions imposed on the rights of Afghans should be removed. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from the Afghan capital.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has called on the Taliban to safeguard the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls. The mission said Taliban's edicts and orders, in many cases, have violated or impinged on the basic rights and freedoms of the population.
The United Nations in Afghanistan is urging the de facto authorities to stop restricting the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls, because those who govern have an immense responsibility as duty bearers to every woman, man, girl, and boy.
In reaction, the Taliban deputy spokesman said the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been committed to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights on the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they are not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turning to Peru now, where protests against the new government is growing bigger every day. Police have clashed with demonstrators who are demanding a national strike, fresh elections, and the release of the former president. This is the fourth consecutive night of protests, with demonstrators gathering in a number of cities. And with one city, police used the tear gas to disperse protesters who fired slingshots and hurled stones. At least one protester has been killed and several others injured during the clashes. They vowed to continue their rallies until Congress is shut down. Former President Pedro Castillo was detained and removed from office on Thursday. That happened after he tried to dissolve Congress hours before his planned impeachment. He's now facing criminal charges. Dina Boluarte, Castillo's vice president, was sworn in as Peru's sixth president in 5 years. Boluarte unveiled her cabinet on Saturday. Elsewhere, four suspects have been charged and remanded in custody in a Belgian investigation into alleged corruption at the European Parliament tied to Qatar. The federal prosecutor's office did not identify the four suspects by name, but a judicial source says they include Greek member of the Parliament, European Parliament, that is, Eva Kaile, and one of the Parliament's vice presidents. The office also said the home of a second MEP was searched on Saturday. The investigation has sent shockwaves through the European Parliament. Prosecutors say World Cup host Qatar is suspected of influencing the decisions of the European Parliament through cash payments or gifts to top figures. Qatar says it's not aware of any details of the investigation, adding that any claims of misconduct by Doha are gravely misinformed. Russia says Europe's attempts to put an end to its reliance on Russian gas are, quote, absurd and frenzied. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Europe has shifted to natural gas imports from the United States in a bid to overcome its dependency on Russian gas. But according to Peskov, the dependency has not ended, as the continent is now leaning on American LNG. The remarks come as the European Union plans to hold an emergency meeting on Tuesday to arrive at an agreement on imposing a price cap on natural gas. Most of the bloc's members are struggling with energy shortages and fuel price hikes caused by the repercussions of the Ukraine war. Ukraine says it will continue to export grain from the southern port city of Odessa, despite the recent Russian attacks targeting local energy infrastructure. The agriculture ministry says traders are facing problems, but for now there's no talk of suspending shipments. According to President Volodymyr Zelensky, the latest round of Russian strikes have left more than 1.5 million people without power in Odessa region. Ukraine is one of the largest grain exporters in the world. It resumed shipments in July after a six-month halt caused by the war, but there have been some disruptions, partially due to the Russian strikes on energy networks since October. Moscow says the strikes are in response to Ukrainian attacks on Russian power lines. More than a dozen people are feared dead in an explosion that flattened an apartment block in the island of Jersey, as rescuers lose hope of finding any survivors.
We brought over a number of specialist assets yesterday and yesterday afternoon, some of which came in Chinooks, thanks to the support of the military, to bring in not only those specialist assets, but also sniffer dogs and the like, to give us the confidence that we need that we have now moved into the recovery phase. So inevitably and tragically and sadly, that is the case.
Smith said around 12 residents are missing and the recovery operation could take weeks. At least three people have been confirmed dead in the blast in the Channel Islands port capital, St. Helier, early Saturday. Police say a gas leak was the likely cause. Fire services had been called to the property several hours before the explosion after residents had reported the smell of gas. The fire chief has conceded that something had gone, quote, horribly wrong. Jersey is a British Crown dependency, not part of the United Kingdom. It has a resident population of just over 100,000 people. Pakistan's Shia Muslims are holding events and ceremonies to mark the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more in this report from Islamabad.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, Islam's faithful followers in Pakistan also observe the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life attended morning ceremonies in different cities and towns across the country to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who is also the wife of the first Shia Imam, Ali ibn Abi Talib. The morning ceremonies included reciting verses from the Holy Quran, congregational prayers, and lectures on the life and sacrifices of the daughter of Islam's last prophet. While highlighting the valuable contributions of Islam's greatest lady, religious scholars said Fatima Zahra is one of the five holy ladies in the history of the world and has a very high position in Islam.
Janabe Zahra, salamullah alayha.
When we say that Fatima Zahra is a role model, we do not mean that this is the only limited to a few areas of her life. This discussion is endless, and we can never stop discussing the greatness of her personality.
Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha.
Fatima Zahra is a shining example not only for women, but every Muslim. She cemented the guidance and teaching which Islam brought and showed us that they are possible to implement in our daily lives.
Some mourners also gave away food to the people in need to mark the occasion. They say that helping others in need is the lesson given to all Muslims by the Prophet Muhammad and his household.
We organize ceremonies every year to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Distributing food is a custom of the Prophet's household, which is to be followed by their faithful followers.
Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon are among the other Muslim countries marking the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra.
While honoring her immense sacrifices and services in the path of Islam, participants in the ceremonies described Fatima Zahra as the best role model, not only for the Muslims, but for the followers of all religions. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Today, Western regimes are misusing the title of human rights against other countries, while their hands are soaked in blood of their own people and people living abroad. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, December 10th is named as Human Rights Day by the United Nations. One of the characteristics of this day is the distraction of phrases from their true meaning, freedom, democracy, human rights, and so on. Today, countries in the world, which are allegedly carrying the epithet of human rights and misusing such a title against other countries, their hands were soaked in the blood of others until recently, vowing to exert additional pressure on the people in independent countries with the same political machinations. In other words, those countries who cannot bear slight anti-security measures in their own countries encourage chaos and insecurity in other countries. For example, the approach of Germany, which has arrested 25 individuals on the charges of seeking to topple the government, should be taken into consideration. It continues to launch a propaganda campaign to promote killing of innocent people in their media platforms. Afterwards, they become advocates of human rights in the light of any bloodshed. Every 10 minutes, a child succumbs to death in Yemen, owing to the war waged by the Saudi-led coalition with the support of Western allies, including the U.S. regime.
Millions of Yemenis have been under siege for more than 7 years, and tens of thousands have died during such an unequal war. In the meantime, Riaz deceived Jamal Khashoggi, a slightly critical journalist, into Turkey and dismembered him with a saw in a diplomatic place, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and dissolved the remains of the body in acid until not even a knuckle is left. In the end, what is the confrontation of the West, especially America, with such a heinous act of crime? Granting political and even judicial immunity to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, as the mastermind of this horrible crime. Of course, such a devilish conduct from America cannot take anyone by surprise. Furthermore, how can a country whose hands are stained with the blood of hundreds of thousands of people in Afghanistan and Iraq and has committed all these crimes in the name of freedom and democracy be a true defender of human rights? The checkered history of the last 300 years of the West is bridled with open and widespread crimes against humanity. If the Western regimes have wealth and power today, one of the main reasons lies in the looting of other nations that continued until the middle of the 20th century. Albeit, the colonialism seems to have ended in its past forms, but its new and modern fashions are lingering intensively. The plight of the oppressed Palestinian people in the past 7 years, in which there was almost no day in which a Palestinian was not killed, injured or arrested by the Zionist regime army, and the way the West faced it on a daily basis, is regarded as one of the indicators of calibrating the level of sincerity of the West in the realm of human rights. In today's world, if a country fares well in the Western camp for their interest, it will receive green light for any crime without being punished. However, if it moves against the current tide of Western countries, they will file a case against that country, making it as a pretext for putting extra political and economic pressure. Yep, this is the American version of human rights. In today's world, human rights and international-related institutions, which are often under the tutelage of the West, are in practice a tool to advance the policies of countries wielding power and influence against the other nations. In the New World Order led by the U.S. and Western version of human rights, which is actually nothing but a law of the jungle, might is right, as George Orwell said in his book Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. In May, news media revealed that U.S. authorities tracked and harassed human rights defenders. Human rights defenders and journalists continued to report intimidation and harassment by U.S. authorities when crossing the U.S.-Mexico border or when conducting their work in Mexico, which impacted both their ability to do their work and their overall well-being. In neighboring Canada, Indigenous authorities have a long way to go before finding the remains of tens of thousands of Native children forcibly taken from their parents and sent to school institutions that resemble dungeons. The practice only ended in 1996, but the Indigenous leaders accused the government of failing to seriously assist them in digging up the bodies and the facts. They were beaten, starved, sexually abused and buried in mass graves just because of their background and the color of their skin. Tens of thousands of French protesters sustained injuries for joining the Yellow Vest protest movement as a result of French policy brutality. Violence against black British citizens by racist officers is still rampant in the UK, America's closest ally in West Asia region. The Zionist regime is massacring women and children at such disturbing rates. Its Western backers should at least be secretly ashamed to support it. Yet, they continue to do so. Israeli human rights violations are too long to list here, as there isn't enough time. So, on International Human Rights Day, there may be a focus on many independent countries in the world. The US axis of allies may have just done enough to spread its disinformation and fake propaganda campaigns while heavily censoring news from official news outlets inside these independent countries. Regarding the Israeli violation of human rights, Wafa News Agency wrote in this regard, the Israeli occupation forces on December 10th opened fire and shot tear gas canisters toward Palestinian farmers and bird hunters along the Gaza Strip's border area with the occupied Palestinian territories. Wafa correspondent reported, he said, the troops stationed along the border fence attacked bird hunters in the northern area and farmers working on their lands in the central and southern regions of the Gaza Strip, forcing them to leave their lands. Attacks against Palestinians attending to the lands are an almost daily occurrence that prevents them from farming their lands.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here are some factors to contemplate upon regarding the all-glorious Creator, whom imagination cannot encompass, as described by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, who is one without partner, he who cannot be perceived with vision, neither be described with tongues, nor can imagination surround his state.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, believing in prophets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of believing in prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. When we are living in an Islamic lifestyle, we need to believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent prophets and messengers for our guidance. And we must believe that there are 124,000 prophets and messengers who were sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The first of them is Prophet Adam alayhi salam, and then the last is Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Therefore, we believe in Prophet Abraham as a prophet, we believe in Moses as a prophet, we believe in Jesus as a prophet, we believe in Elias, we believe in Joseph, and all those who were sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have almost 24 to 25 names in the Quran about the prophets, and the rest are also the prophets, the names which were not mentioned, maybe they are mentioned in the history. So we must believe in them, and to be a Muslim, we must believe. Now, this is the first part, that we must believe in 124,000 prophets. The second thing is, when we are believing in these prophets, we must follow them because they were the role models for us, and we must follow their footsteps in order to have a good Islamic lifestyle. For example, in the Quran, Allah gave the example of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, or Prophet Joseph alayhi salam, that he didn't went towards the indecency. Therefore, our youth must save themselves from the indecency, and they must keep their purification safe in order to reach the perfection, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of believing in prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We were giving some examples, and we said that, for example, in the Quran, Allah has given the example of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, where he didn't went towards the indecency. He saved himself from indecency, and he remained purified. Therefore, our youth must save themselves. Similarly, in the Quran, we have the example of the mother of a prophet, which is the Lady Mary, the Virgin Mary. And the Quran tells us that she also was one of the most purified personalities. And she's amongst the great four ladies which Islam has introduced. And therefore, our ladies, our girls, our sisters, our mothers, our daughters, they must keep their veil, hijab, they must keep their purification, they must save it. On the other hand, we have other examples as well. So the prophets, when we are believing in prophets, it's not just a matter of believing in 124,000 prophets and messengers. Rather, while we believe that this number of prophets and messengers were sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the next step in the Islamic lifestyle is to follow their footsteps. The Quran has described their role. The Quran has described how they lived. It talks about the seerah of these prophets, the living style of these prophets, what they did, how they were against the oppression, how they raised their voice, how they were, bringing the justice to the society. So they are the role models. Therefore, we must follow the footsteps of these prophets. And this is known as believing in prophets. When we say in the Islamic lifestyle, we must believe in prophets. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Sideline.
Welcome to The Sideline, where we discuss the latest hot topics of the FIFA World Cup 2022. I'm your host, Hamza Khayoun. Today, we'll explore the stunning solidarity shown with the resistant people of Palestine throughout this competition. Scenes of jubilation at Moroccan and Tunisian victories have been accompanied by patriotic songs supporting Palestine. From pitch invasions to confrontation of Israeli journalists, this World Cup has shown the normalization push for the region is doomed to fail. While some misguided regimes seek to ingratiate themselves with only the Zionist entity, the people of the region vehemently reject these actions. We'll hear from experts on this subject, but before that, we have a special report on some of the breathtaking displays of solidarity the tournament has witnessed.
This World Cup has seen an outpouring of support for the Palestinian cause. While this is not new, it has never been on such an international stage. There have been stunning examples of support for Palestine in the world of football, such as the stand taken by Celtic fans and even a special twinning of the club with the Aida refugee camp. Footballers have gone to great lengths to show they support the liberation of Palestine. This time, though, the fans have taken center stage. Israeli journalists have struggled to convince people to talk to them, even finding themselves unable to engage fans from Japan and Brazil. The situation has gotten to the point that the Zionist entity has advised those from the settler colony not to travel to Qatar anymore because of the discomfort they may face there. Many have pointed to the gulf between Israeli journalists being ignored or shouted down in Qatar and Palestinian journalists being killed in occupied Palestine. There's a board dedicated to Shireen Abu Akleh in Qatar, which has been decorated with signs of respect from World Cup goers. Here at The Sideline, we've collated some of the most epic examples of solidarity with Palestine shown in Qatar this month. Fans of both Tunisia and Morocco have been holding massive banners with the words Free Palestine during their matches. A Saudi Arabian supporter was recorded vehemently telling Israeli journalist Moav Vardi that he was not welcome in Qatar. It is Palestine. There is no Israel.
You are not welcome here. Even if this is Qatar, this is our country, you are not welcome here. There is only Palestine. There is no Israel.
An Israeli journalist was even forced to lie, claiming he came from Ecuador to cover his affiliation to the Zionist entity. Perhaps he did. As the competition approached, Zionist media speculated if this was the World Cup that could serve as a vehicle through which Qatar could be dragged into the normalization camp. However, as was revealed, even those from states that have normalized relations with Israel are unambiguously rejecting it. Whilst Palestine has not qualified for the World Cup 2022, its pulsating presence is felt as a reminder of a people striving to be free.
We are joined in the studio by our resident football analyst, Mo Haider. Mo was a key figure in the development of Arsenal Fan TV, where he was eventually dismissed for his public support for the Palestinian cause. Now he runs his own YouTube channel where he provides cutting-edge analysis and incisive commentary on the latest Arsenal games. We are joined on Skype by Sami Ramadani. Sami is an Iraqi-born lecturer in sociology and writes on Iraq and Middle East current affairs. He was a political exile from Saddam's regime but campaigned against US-led sanctions and the invasion and occupation of Iraq. He's a member of the Steering Committee of Stop the War Coalition. Thank you very much for joining me, gentlemen. So, Mo, did you expect such a strong presence in this competition for the Palestinians?
Well, given that Palestine didn't qualify for the World Cup, you tell me what other country didn't qualify and has had such a strong presence. I didn't expect it to the extent that we've seen it. And look, clearly the presence of Palestine is not in the field of play, but it's in the hearts of the people. And it's a really, really lovely thing to see.
Sami, what do you think the support for the Palestinians says about the normalization push in the region?
Well, it revealed so starkly the huge gulf that exists between the Arab regimes and the masses in general. The Arab masses have shown for the first opportunity, or rather used the first opportunity where the world media is focused on Qatar and the World Cup. They showed how much they love Palestine and how much they do support the Palestinian people and reject any notion of normalization with the occupation of Palestine. And that stark example is not unique, but it is unique in the sense that the world media were present and the world could see how much the Arab people, and actually people from other nations, raised the Palestinian flag and rejected talking to Israeli journalists. So it was a reminder, and in fact, a slap in the face as well for both the Israeli occupation of Palestine and for the Arab regimes who are trying to normalize relations with the Zionists.
Absolutely. Mo, what did you make of that pitch invasion during Tunisia's victory over France?
Well, pitch invasions generally, not something I condone, but as soon as something is done with a Palestine presence, given the suppression that anything Palestine-related faces, especially in the West, I'm all for it. And frankly, if anyone was to have an issue with the pitch invasion, I'd focus on the issues that are going on in Palestine as something that's far more worthy of our focus and our complaints. So the pitch invasion, though it's not really shown on broadcasters because they try to keep attention away from these things, on social media, you can all see it. And you have to admit, the backflip was brilliant.
Sammy, we saw an Israeli journalist claiming he was from Ecuador, and Israelis now have been advised not to travel to Qatar. Has this competition been an embarrassment for the Zionist entity?
Actually, much more than an embarrassment, because you could see that the Israeli media were trying to show the people in the world that Israel has been accepted and the people are okay with their journalist presence. And suddenly they met with this incredible hostility and a reminder that Palestine and the occupation of Palestine is a key issue for the Arab people in general and for actually people from across the world, that Palestine and occupied Palestine will never be forgotten. And the Israeli ploy to show that normalization is a normal event has It countered on them, and they failed miserably to prove any point except that the people reject them.
Mo, what's been your favourite pro-Palestine moment in this competition?
Well, actually, do you know what? It's not one individual moment. It's actually one thing that's happened on numerous occasions, and that is the reaction of normal match-going fans to Israeli journalists. It's so, so important that we never allow this to be normalised. It's not normal to breach international law. It's not normal that human rights organisations are concluding that there is apartheid in this region. So the reaction of fans in such an organic manner to say, no, we're not going to normalise this, we do not want to have anything to do with you and we reject your presence, is brilliant. And crucially, from every clip that I have seen, it's been done without abusive behaviour or abusive language. It's just a polite but very firm and assertive rejection, and long may it continue.
Sami, we have even seen Saudis denouncing Israeli journalists at the stadiums. What message will that send to the Saudi regime?
Actually, it was quite important, even though it was one individual, because there is a lot of repression in Saudi of people expressing opinions nowadays, supporting the Palestinian people and rejecting Israeli occupation. So that person was extremely brave confronting the Israeli journalist. The Saudi regime is known to have secret relations with the Israeli occupation. And recently, these things have become more public with the permission of flights and Israeli visits to Saudi. So the Saudi regime has cornered itself in a way, because the feelings are running quite high that this will be rejected, and the Saudi regime has in a sense put its wrong foot forward, because normally they hide behind the scenes.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us on the sideline today. We'll be back throughout the tournament with more debate and analysis. Until then, goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently said he's convinced the United States will be able to call Sweden and Finland NATO allies soon, and claimed Turkey's concerns about the two nations joining the NATO alliance are being addressed. Antony Blinken, speaking at a press briefing following meetings at the State Department with his Swedish and Finnish counterparts, said the two nations are already integrating into the work of the alliance. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said Sweden and Finland will soon become NATO allies, despite Turkey's concerns about the two countries joining the Western military alliance. Speaking at a press briefing following meetings at the U.S. State Department with his Swedish and Finnish counterparts on Thursday, 8th of December, Antony Blinken claimed the two nations are already integrating into the work of the alliance. Blinken said, "This is not a bilateral issue between the United States and Turkey, and it's not going to turn into one." He claimed that Finland and Sweden have had a productive process working with Turkey to address concerns, and concrete steps have been taken. He added, "I have every expectation that both nations will formally become NATO members soon." Finland and Sweden both asked to join NATO recently in the wake of Russia's special operation in Ukraine, but Turkey opposed their request until a number of demands were met. The two Nordic nations required the approval of all 30 NATO member states to join the alliance. Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto said Finland hoped to finalise the process of NATO membership soon. He said, "We take the security concerns of all allies seriously. Finland is a security provider whose membership will further strengthen the alliance as a whole." Swedish Foreign Minister Tobias Billström claimed that NATO accession process was progressing well. The Prime Ministers of Finland and Sweden have urged Hungary and Turkey to approve their countries' applications to join NATO, but Ankara insisted it would not lift its objections without further extraditions of suspects it considers terrorists. Budapest said Recently, it supported the applications and its parliament would ratify them by mid-December. But Ankara has again signalled it wants concrete action against groups that it deems to be terrorists. Finland's Prime Minister Sanna Marin said recently, "All eyes are now on Hungary and Turkey. We are waiting for these countries to ratify our applications. I think it will be important that this would happen preferably sooner rather than later." Sweden's new Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson claimed recently that Sweden had full respect for the fact that every country within the alliance makes its own decisions. Turkey objected to the applications even before they were submitted, citing the country's history of hosting members of the Kurdish militant groups such as the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, and the followers of the US-based Muslim preacher Fethullah Gulen, as well as the 2019 suspension of arms sales. The previous Swedish government followed through on parts of a June memorandum signed with Turkey to win Ankara's support, lifting the arms embargo and blocking financial and other support for Kurdish groups in Syria, such as the so-called YPG. The website defensepost.com writes, "Finland and Sweden joined the United States on Thursday, 8th of December, in asking Turkey for its green light, soon to join NATO, claiming they have been fulfilling promises sought by Ankara on militants. Turkey has demanded that the two countries take tougher stances on Kurdish militants that it considers terrorists, in exchange for backing their NATO bids. Sweden recently extradited Mahmoud Tat, who is wanted by Ankara for membership in the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. Also, the Turkish foreign minister said recently that Finland must publicly declare that it's lifting an arms embargo on Turkey to win Ankara's approval for its membership of NATO. Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, the Turkish foreign minister, made the comments ahead of a visit by Finland's defense minister, Antti Kaikkonen. Kaikkonen, who has discussed his nation's bid to join the military alliance with his Turkish counterpart, Hulusi Akar. Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, the Turkish foreign minister, told reporters, "The Finnish defense minister's visit to Turkey is important because we have not yet heard a statement from Finland saying they've lifted their arms embargo against us. We're expecting such a statement from there." The Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto claimed that commitments made earlier this year to Turkey by both countries were being very much fulfilled. He voiced hope that Sweden and Finland would join NATO by February, the date when the other initial holdout, Hungary, has pledged to approve their accession. The Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto said, "Of course, what we're still missing is a clear date and a clear plan of the Turkish parliament to deal with this issue. We know that Turkey is going to elections. Of course, our hope is that this decision should come from Turkey rather sooner rather than later." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is up for re-election this June, and some experts have speculated that he will show an uncompromising attitude until then. Sweden and Finland both have close ties with Western militaries, but have historically stopped short of open alliances for fear of angering nearby Russia. Their hesitation changed after Russia started its special operation in Ukraine. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. President Vladimir Putin of Russia has issued fresh warnings that Russia would respond in kind if NATO set up military infrastructure in Finland and Sweden after they joined the US-led alliance. Vladimir Putin was quoted by Russian news agencies as saying that he could not rule out that tensions would emerge in Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm over joining NATO. The Russian President Vladimir Putin told a news conference in Ashgabat, the capital of Turkmenistan. He said, "We don't have problems with Sweden and Finland like we do with Ukraine. We don't have territorial differences." President Putin added, "If Finland and Sweden wish to, they can join. That's up to them. They can join whatever they want." However, he warned, "If military contingents and military infrastructure were deployed there, we would be obliged to respond symmetrically and raise the same threats for those territories where threats have arisen for us." Russia has repeatedly warned Finland and Sweden against joining NATO, saying the serious military and political consequences of such a move would oblige it to restore military balance by strengthening its defences in the Baltic Sea region, including by deploying nuclear weapons. Russian officials earlier reacted angrily to NATO's offer of membership to Finland and Sweden, calling it a destabilising effort that will increase tensions in the region. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said, "We condemn the irresponsible course of the North Atlantic Alliance that is ruining the European architecture and what's left of it." Ryabkov added, "I have a great deal of doubt as to whether the upcoming period will be calm for our North European neighbours."
Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum and peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the new show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we'll be looking at a trending story from the news world which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today we'll be focusing on the World Cup football tournament, which for the first time ever is being hosted by a Muslim-majority Arab country in the Middle East, and whether or not the Qatari authorities have done enough to safeguard Islamic values amid the avalanche of non-Muslim guests and Western pressure.
Has Qatar compromised Islamic principles to host the 2022 World Cup? Amid an intense pressure campaign from European nations to change local laws, some Muslim onlookers fear Doha may have compromised too much to cater for their non-Muslim guests. Qatar has been condemned by the West over Sharia-inspired laws, which ban alcohol consumption, public displays of affection, same-sex relationships, and immodest dress codes. However, Doha has made exemptions on some of these rules for visiting spectators, including fan zones which allow alcohol sales, creating a debate between fans.
Alcohol, I think, is sold in many other places. But it's forbidden to drink alcohol in the street or in the stadiums or other public places. So I'm supporting to respect the Islamic rules or the Islamic countries or the Islamic conditions.
If that's the case, I don't think that should be. I don't think that should be the decision that they should make, especially when they did have plans for international beverages, different tents set up.
I don't want to, I'll be the last person you ask this question. I wouldn't want to see that lifestyle compromised. I wouldn't want to, with my kids and my family enjoying my time out. And